session number 10763, rule 3.
Wing Commander Lucas, Rule 3.
And when we were out there making this film for Scottish Television, we paid two or three visits to the War Museum, and of course they took the opportunity, which wouldn't otherwise have been given to them, of doing sort of tape recordings on with two or three of us who were out there, because there were very few survivors, and I think that we were only sort of three or four of the survivors who were out there. And I can remember Philip Vellor asking me, he said, did you consider that the Maltese population were really remarkable during this siege? And because he said, we've heard some sort of contrary views expressed. And I said quite openly to him that I thought that, on the whole, their courage was remarkable, and particularly the women and particularly the children. I remember them so well. I thought that they put up... But I did think that some of the Maltese men were a bit offensive, and because they'd see a lot of pilots walking about Valletta when there were these air raids going on, they never realized that there were so few Spitfires for us to fly, and so they couldn't really quite understand, and I thought that perhaps sometimes that they were really quite rude to us, and I'd point and say, "Pilot, pilot," and he got awfully annoyed when and I, after all, I was only just telling the truth. But the truth was that the civilian population, I mean, taken broadly, they were quite, because they were being hammered, I mean, night after night and day after day from whatever it was, well, the end of 41 onwards. I mean, before that they were being bombed, but I mean, the real weight of the bombing came in the spring and the early summer of 1942. But I can remember one thing which impressed me, because I'm a sort of reasonable practicing Christian, I like to think. I'd been off, I was a flight commander in the squadron then, hadn't quite taken it over, and I should think that it was probably towards the end of May, and my flight, we'd been off having a go at some 88s and things south of the island. They were coming round. It was in the late-ish afternoon, and so the afternoon sun, they were trying to come in from the west and I think attack Lucca. And we'd had a go to with some 109s, and I'd got hit in the radiator, in the coolant. Well, the moment that that happens, you start to lose the glycol. The temperature goes up, and if you can't sort of get back in time, well, the engine seizes up and you're fixed. And anyway, this was about, oh, I think, 15 miles southwest of the island, off Delamara Point. And I realized what was happening. I didn't get the aeroplane, so I didn't come off particularly well. And there was another one behind, which I hadn't seen and all that. And I headed straight back for the island. And then I saw the temperature eventually going off the clock. And so I realized I wasn't going to make it, but I had enough height to get back to the island. I didn't have to bail out. I never bailed out. I always had a sort of fear of bailing out. And I cut all the switches so that it wouldn't catch fire, or I hoped it wouldn't catch fire. And I'd got, I suppose, to within about... with 4,000 feet, I think, 3,000 or 4,000 feet to spare, I got to within about 4, 5, 6 miles, I should think, of Lucca, just heading straight in, the sun behind. And I saw this smoke beginning to start, and I thought, oh, God. And I thought to myself, I'm not going to bail out. And Malta is a terribly difficult place to force land, because, do you know it, it's full of these little... sort of trace work walls, stone walls, little allotments, and there's nowhere where you've really got room. Anyway, I could see one field down there, a little thing. It was only, I don't know, 100 yards or something long, about the same wide. And I thought, well, I'll have a try at it. And it just so happened, I think the Lord was on my side. I managed to slip off the height and put the aircraft down, absolutely slap in the middle of this field, wheels up, of course. And it was an extraordinary landing. I mean, I'd never do it again if I tried, I can assure you of that. And it was a field where there'd been potatoes. And there were three old women, old Maltese women. And I can see them now in these great long black, thick sort of black dresses with, look as if they'd got about half a dozen dresses on, these great voluminous skirts right down to their ankles. And these sort of bandos over their heads. And they'd been obviously working away on these potatoes, and they'd got sacks full of them. And I put the aeroplane down. I got out of the aeroplane. I was absolutely all right. I wasn't touched at all. And here was this thing beginning to smoulder. Well, they could see it smouldering, and they didn't know the first thing about it, and they couldn't speak English. Well, I could understand it anyway. And they emptied. I can see them now doing it. They emptied all the potatoes out, and they started filling the sacks, ordinary sort of Hessian sacks, full of earth, and climbing up onto the wing and sort of pouring this thing onto the top of the cowling of the Spitfire, where all the smoke was coming from. And the most extraordinary thing was, and there was no reason for it, that the actual smoke stopped. And they'd been doing this, I suppose, for about... And I didn't want to stop them, because, you know, they were sort of spirited and all that. And they'd been doing it for about 10 minutes, I suppose, and then eventually they finished. And one, the oldest of them, a lovely old girl, came up to me, and she put her hand on my forearm and made the sign of the cross on her chest, and then turned away with the rest of them, by which time someone was coming to collect me, because it was a very short distance and I'd seen it happen. And it was the most extraordinary sort of union of the Roman and Anglican churches. It was an extraordinary experience, and they were absolutely marvellous, those people. And I think that the women, I have no doubt at all that the women really had the most remarkable courage there. They were the ones who struck me, and I thought that children, because they were so good with the children, that was the thing. Somehow or other they kept them quiet and things. But as I say, I mean, the men were fine, but there were sort of critical elements among them. As a matter of fact, when we were out there in 1982, my generation of Maltese were just as patriotic as ever. They'd all been in the service, the ones that we were talking to. They'd been in those Maltese anti-aircraft batteries, so they were blooming marvellous all the way around that northeast area facing Sicily. And they were just the same, Godfrey Caruana and all these fellows. And but the young then sort of aged about 21 or 22, I mean, there's no doubt that they were beholden to Gaddafi. There's no question of that. I mean, they didn't fancy us when we were out there doing this filming. Very extraordinary, the difference between the two. But I'm told now by my friends that since they've had this change of government, the things are beginning to change again. It's rather interesting, actually. But anyway, that's beside the point.
Was the war against the Germans and Italians in Malta fought in a ruthless spirit, or was it fought in a knightly spirit, as it were?
Well, if you read some of the stuff about Malta, you will see that there are a number of references to pilots bailing out and being shot down or shot at as they bailed out. Now, that's a sort of an emotive subject. Now, one can only form judgments from what one saw oneself, and not so much from hearsay. And I only once myself personally saw a pilot attacked by a Messerschmitt when he was bailing out. And that was a Rhodesian called Dougie Lego, L-E-G-G-O. And we'd been vectored onto a raid, and I think it's fair to say that the raid was coming in from the northeast, from Sicily, and there had been a fighter sweep of the German Luftwaffe, which had been sent round to the south of the island to come in behind us, the intercepting force. And I'm bound to say that I didn't see it. I was leading, I think, 8 aeroplanes, and suddenly there were great splodges of explosions, you know, cannon shells all over the place. I wasn't hit. But Dougie Lego, who was flying right out on the left, I saw this aircraft and I said, "Break left," but he didn't break quick enough and he was hit. And he rolled over and bailed out, and I saw his parachute open. I said, "No, going down." We're, I suppose, at 22 or 23,000 feet. And I turned the squadron round, two of 8 aircraft round to the left, or 7 as it was then. And we were over the top, and then suddenly I saw a 109 with his parachute was wide open, right out, Dougie's parachute was right open. And I saw a 109 come round and just squirt at the, and of course it streamed and it was down, he was killed. Now, that was the only time that I saw that happen. And it's the only proved time that I know that it happened. Now, there was a Canadian flying with us and the other 4. And he was particularly friendly with Dougie. And 2 days later, or two or three days later, there was a Dornier 24, which was their float plane, which they used for air sea rescue, which with an escort of 109s was looking for a crew of an 88, 3 crew of an 88, in a dinghy southwest of Delimara Point, which is in the southwest of the island, about 12 or 15 miles out, I suppose. And the controller, Woody, said that there's this aeroplane. He said that Dornier 24, don't worry about the Dornier 24, he said, but if you can get after some of those Messerschmitts round it, we'll have a go at that. And we went out, and we didn't see the Dornier until quite late on, but we did see the dinghy, the 88 crew's dinghy with 3 pilots in it. Now, and then we saw the 109s, and we got into them and led them into them. And then I looked out on the side, and we'd had this sort of skirmish with them, and I looked out, and there was a Spitfire going straight down at this dinghy with these 3 people, and I could see the cannon shells and the machine guns starting short of the dinghy and pulling straight through it, and of course he'd got the lot. And when he came down, I took him aside. I don't know that anyone else actually saw it. And I took him aside and I said, "So long as I command this squadron, you will never do that again." And he said, "You know, we had a sort of fairly free and easy transatlantic relationship there." And he said, "Boss, I'm sorry I did it." And he really genuinely was. But the thing is that in war, one bad turn begat another. And if this guy hadn't seen Dougie gunned down by this Messerschmitt, he would never have done that with those things. And I don't believe that this, but he was a first-class chap, but he was just simply, and don't forget this fellow, Lego, he was his mate, and when you were living close together in those sort of circumstances, they developed a tremendously sort of intimate relationship because you were dependent, particularly if you were flying together one on the other. I mean, it was an almost sort of, if you like, unnatural human relationship in those circumstances. But the feelings were intense, and this thing simply got the better of him, and he could see an opportunity of getting even. But these things, the answer to your question is really, there was, I think, that there was a lot of chivalry in the air there, much more. Now, Johnny Johnson, my friend, I expect you probably know him. He doesn't have any of that. I mean, but I know Johnny so well. He's a rough character. He's a splendid man. And when I had a wing at Coltishall in 1943, and he had the Kenley wing, and we used to do the close escort for these things in our Spitfire fives, and he had these Canadian wing of Spitfire 9Bs, and I can see him leading that wing now. He's a really aggressive chap, and he felt that there was none of this chivalry. Well, I'm sure that there was in Malta, and I tell you, we used to go, and I, to be honest, to begin with, I encouraged it. When one of our fellows had shot a German down, who had perhaps then been injured, and he had gone to hospital, we used to go along and talk to him in hospital, and not because we wanted to get information from them, but it was just like a sort of couple of fishermen, you know, talking. I mean, it was the most extraordinary relationship, really, in the air. I'm sure, I don't think, I may be wrong about it, I don't believe that that sort of relationship existed almost anywhere else. It might have done in submarines, I think, but there was a sort of common denominator. That's it. It was a sort of common denominator. It was the air, and you wanted to know what they thought of this and thought of that, and you wanted to talk to him, like Phyllis, saying, well, what size of the fish you got out of the pond and all that. And there was a German called Kurt Lauinger, Lauinger, who was a southern German. He was well educated, he could speak English well, and obviously a sort of fairly erudite young man. And he'd been shot down by Norman McQueen, who is a Welshman in 249. I was a flight commander then. And after he'd been shot down, he'd broken an arm, I think, and I have an idea he'd broken a leg, and he was in Mtafa Hospital, which was only about sort of 3 or 4 miles away from us, in Imdina, Rabat. And so we went over and saw him about 2 or 3 days later. And I remember two things in particular about him. When he realized that we weren't there to try to find out how many squadrons there were and what they'd got, this, that, and the other, I mean, we were just simply going to have a talk like fighter pilots do, or did, what we were interested in was the relationship between the Italian fighter pilots and the Germans in Sicily, because obviously, I mean, our main concern was with the Luftwaffe and not with the Regio Aeronautica, although some of them actually were very much better than they were given credit for. And the Norman McQueen, who had shot him down, said to him, what did you think of the Italian pilots? And Kurt Lauinger, he was sort of propped up in bed with one leg up here and an arm sort of in a sling over here, and he'd got his free right arm, and there was a torch on the table beside the bed, and he got hold of this torch, switched it on, and looked under the bed, you know, sort of half lifted the bedclothes up with one arm and shone the torch under the bed, and he said, as much as to say, you can never find them. And the now, to be honest, Edu Neumann said that the Italians were much better than they were given credit for, and he had a lot of, but that's quite a separate thing. But the other thing I remember about Lauinger, and he was such a nice man, you know, I mean, it's ridiculous really, but you see, one in the air, I don't think you ever felt this real animosity. Some people did, I never did, and I've got a lot of German friends now who are in the Luftwaffe. I see them when they come here, it might be like you or anyone. And while Kurt Lauinger was in the hospital, his group leader, a chap called Neuhoff, Neuhoff, was shot down by another Rhodesian whose name was Zulu Buchanan. I don't know what his other, any other called him Zulu, and he was a policeman in the Rhodesian police force. And we said to, after this, we went to see Lauinger, and we said, well, your wing leader, your group leader, has been shot down. And he'd got 38 Neuhoff, which was a lot of aeroplanes. And he said, no, he, whatever his Christian name was, he said, oh, no, he hasn't been shot down. Wouldn't believe it. And so I said to him, well, look, if you don't believe it, write a note to him and we'll have it taken over. He was in some other hospital on the other side of the island, on the east side of the island, and we'll get a message to him and a message back so that you know he is. I promise you, he's been shot down. Neuhoff. Oh, no. Anyhow, he wrote out, and funnily enough, I got it here. I can't speak German, but he wrote this thing out, and that was it. And if you can't read German, there's probably no point in it. But anyhow, that was the message that he wrote in pencil. And don't forget, I mean, he was propped up in bed, difficult to write it. Anyhow, this message was taken to Neuhoff by one of our chaps, who was tremendously amused, apparently, by it. And he wrote out another message saying, yes, well, I am here, and I have been shot down, and this, that, and the other, so you've got to believe it. Well, unfortunately, I never got the other message which came back, so I've only got the one that he wrote to Neuhoff. And so it shows you, you know, that they had this extraordinary, almost fanatical belief in their leaders. There's no doubt in it. Lauinger, I suppose, was a young man of probably 22, something, some age, and this chap, Neuhoff, was his sort of hero. But we did have some interesting times talking to these pilots, and then there was one, a terrible experience, which made me stop it altogether, because there was one day towards the end of, I was commanding the squadron then, and it was towards the end of, early part of July. I was getting very near the end of my time. I remember I was exhausted then, and there was a, Woodall was controlling, and there was a raid, and we had eight aeroplanes up, and there was a raid which was building up over Sicily, and Woodall, as usual, he rang up on the operations line and the dispersal, and he said, there is a raid building up. It looks as if it's going to be quite big. I will get you off the ground in about 5 minutes, and then you climb up. And this was in the morning, about 11 o'clock. Climb up to the south, get the height, and I'll bring you in. And we followed the normal procedure, got the height, and he said, there are three big jobs, and they were, in point of fact, Savoia Machete, 79s, Italians, surrounded by about 80 or 90 Messerschmitts, and doing the high cover and the close escort. And we were well above, old Woody had got us up, well above the height of the incoming raid. And his last instruction, he said, was, they are now approaching, the usual thing, now approaching St. Paul's Bay, St. Paul's Island, soon be crossing St. Paul's Bay and the coast. Suggest you come in now and come in fast. Well, I could see these three Italian bombers, and I could see the stuff all around, and we had eight against, as I say, I think 80 plus, 80 to 100 plus. I think he said there are 80 plus. And so I said to them, we'll take, my section will take the bomber to port. They were flying in a Vic of three, very tight. And we'll take the bomber to port, and the two sections, your left-hand section, your yellow section, takes the middle one, and the two aircraft on the other side take the outside one on the starboard. And we went straight through these, and you know, it worked. It was just one of those things. You remember getting right close into the thing and giving it a squirt, hitting the thing all over the blooming place. And then my number two got it, and then we go, anyhow, long and the short of it was, we got all three of these things, and they went down in flames, absolutely, right over the top of the island. And when we got down, and I said to these fellows, don't you mix it now with these 109s, because we're outnumbered to such an extent. We've got the bombers, and now we're clear of them. We went down, and they never followed us down. And so it was a real sort of Wembley job, you know, 100,000 people cheering the chap shooting the goal. Anyhow, when we got down and landed at Tecale, old Screwball Burling, who was this extraordinary character in 249, this Canadian, who was a simply super pilot, and we ought to say something about him. He was waiting in the dispersal height. He wasn't on flying at all, but he was just down there because he was interested in it. He was a nutcase. And as I came and walked in, and absolutely soaked with sweat, he'd seen it all over the top of the island, and he'd got this marvellous eyesight, old Screwball, and he just looked at me and he said, "Boss," he said, "I couldn't fault that one." And I've never forgotten it. Anyhow, one of these fellas in the Italian Italian aircraft that we had shot down on the left hand, the port one, his name was Peluzzi, P-E-L-U-Z-Z-I, and he was a gunner. And he and his mates, who'd been picked up, had been sent to the hospital, not in Taffa, but one on the east side of the island. And so, because it had been rather a sort of special victory and that, he said, "All right, well, we'll go and see him." And we went to this hospital. I can't remember the name of the place, actually, where it was now. But anyhow, we went up to the ward, and I remember saying to the sister, "This is two of my, about three mates here of mine from 249. We shot these three Italian bombers down yesterday, or the day before yesterday. And if there are any of them here, well, if they're all right, we just have a talk with them." And she said, "Well, there's one here," but she said, "he's been wounded." And I walked across to the bed where he was in the far corner of this ward, very bright ward. I remember thinking how bright it was. And as I walked up to him, he saw, of course, with our uniforms, the khaki thing, the wings, and his arm, whole of his arm was bandaged, and he held this arm up like this, and his hand had been taken off. He'd been hit in the thing, and he'd had the hand amputated. And there was another, he couldn't speak English, but there was another Italian who was all right. I mean, he bailed out too and knew this chap. And he was able to speak English. And he said, "That man is a violinist." That's all he said. And you know, it absolutely, because I'm not a belligerent person, at least everyone sort of worked away at it, but I'm not like that. And it absolutely turned me over. And the moment that we'd finished it, I'd made up my mind that no one in our squadron would ever see a wounded prisoner again. And they never did. And then I don't know whether they did afterwards, I have no idea. But anyhow, I stopped it. I wasn't going to have that, because it was the most traumatic feeling to see it. I don't know. Really turned me over. Funny in the middle of a war when you're steeled against that sort of thing. But every once in a while, I mean, how can they do that stuff in China? I don't know. It just amazes me.
So it obviously could have affected the performance of your pilots.
Oh, I think it depended on each man, I think, individually, to be honest. But I'm bound to say that now Raoul Dadolonglé came with me that day, I remember, because he'd been flying, and a New Zealander called Jack Ray, who was still living. And I think that they both felt that it was really sort of traumatic, so traumatic that it really, they didn't sort of know.